does evolution undermine Christianity? I'm going to start giving you what I mean by Christianity here.
Okay.
And note that these are very carefully titled. Three philosophically interesting Christian theses relevant to evolution. Okay, so there's lots of theses that would be essential to Christianity. Okay. There's lots of theses, I think, that are central to or essential to Christianity that are relevant to evolution. Okay. I've limited even further than that. I'm just going to talk about three theses that I think philosophers have something to say about that are central to Christianity and are relevant to evolution. Does that make sense? So I've kind of weaseled my way into not having to talk about things I don't want to talk about. Okay. All right. So there are three theses here, or three notions here, that I think are important for us in our conversation. First one is Imago Dei. Quote, God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. And quote from Genesis, there's a distinctive set of capacities. Typically, we think of these as human beings have a kind of theoretical reason, or they're capable of a kind of moral reason or practical reason, right, that are distinct among the capacities of other animals, right, or of all other creatures. Okay. And by creature, I just mean something created. Right? And so the idea here is that not only are these distinct, but somehow we resemble God in a more distinct way in virtue of having these capacities. Okay. There's a lot of different claims that you can find as to what these capacities are. Like I mentioned, moral reason. I mentioned theoretical reason. Sometimes you'll hear, you know, people will say it's the fact that we're free, or able to, like, self-determinedly free in ways that other creatures aren't. Some might say it's the fact that we raise these kinds of questions is what's distinctive about us. Some might say it's our ability to have aesthetic judgment. Okay, I'm less concerned here for what that capacity is. Okay, we can talk about that. It's just a question of whether or not, in light of evolution, we can say there is indeed a capacity that human beings have that distinguishes them from all their animals, whatever that may be. Does that make sense? Okay. Second, special creation. Quoting, the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground and blew into his nostrils the breath of life. And quote from Genesis. And here I mean by this, the origination of the human species came about by a creative act distinct from that by which all other creatures came about. That is, humans are genealogically distinct from all other animals. Okay. And by genealogically, I mean they are generically. They have an origin distinct from all other animals. Okay. Something special happened to bring us about that was not present in the bringing about of other animals. And once again, just I'm less concerned with what that act is and more concerned with, can we claim that there was such an act and still accept certain things that we seem to be finding out about the evolutionary history of the human race. Okay. Third notion. I just call it natural theology. Quote, ever since the creation of the world, his attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made. As a result, they have no excuse. End quote from St. Paul in Romans. The claim here that Paul seems to be making, you can find this in, you know, other books, the Book of Wisdom, you'll find this sort of thing, is that nature is a rational order such that we can determine that a being like God is somehow responsible for it. And what's interesting about what St. Paul says here is that, you know, they have no excuse. He's talking about non-Judeo-Christian pagans here. I mean, they have no excuse for things they're doing contrary to natural law, things they're doing contrary to monotheism, because it's obvious, given when you look out on creation, that God's running this show somehow. Okay. Does that make sense? All right. Now, a couple more hedges before I get going here. All right. I'm going to leave natural theology aside. Okay. We can talk about it in question and answer, but I'm not going to address that directly here. Not that I don't think it can be addressed. I just think that what mostly vexes us about evolution, right, is the human nature part. Okay. We can talk about natural theology, but I'm not going to go to it directly. Secondly, in discussing Imago Dei and special creation, I'm not going to get into any of the particularities of the biblical texts. Okay, so I'm not interested for our purposes in whether or not creation happened over a course of 6 days. Okay, I'm not interested in whether or not there was a definite set of human parents, Adam and Eve, from which we're all descended. Okay, that those I think are properly theological matters. I don't make my living doing that. I won't comment on that. You see, I mean, that's another kind of issue I'm not qualified to talk about. I highly recommend to you, though, to check out work by a colleague of mine at Benedictine, Matthew Ramage. I think has written very well about this, and he has more of the pipe. He's an Old Testament biblical scholar,
right?
So I'll punt to Matt. Okay. All right. So the two theses I'm most concerned with respect to Christianity are Imago Dei, which is to say humans are ontologically distinct from all other animals. There's a capacity we have that marks us as a different kind of thing from other animals. Okay. And two, I'm interested in special creation, right? That humans are somehow genealogically, right? We have an origin distinct from other animals. All right. Now, so on the one hand, that's the Christian claim I'm most concerned about right now. On the other hand, I want to look at what I'm going to call this case for human evolution. Two theses here. First, evolution. Just following the handout. The currently best available explanation of biodiversity, that is the differentiation of species, can be given in terms of one, common descent, moved by two, chance mutation, three, natural selection, and, three, natural selection, and four, genetic transmission, operating within the physical laws of nature. Okay. So what is evolution? It's the idea that we can explain how we got the set of organism types that we have now, right, the species we have now, through common descent from prior ancestry, right, chance mutation, natural selection, and genetic transmission operating within the laws of physics. Okay. I think to say much can be said for that, right? So one, we can say there's at least an inference to the best available explanation for evolution, meaning of all the things on offer, how we could explain the current state of biodiversity, you know, on Earth today, it does seem that is the best one available, right? Do you see my point? Okay. Secondly, something could be the best available explanation, but actually have very little evidence directly for it. Right? It could be a very low probability claim, but it's just the best one available. Do you see that? Okay, so you could, let's say you know your roommate to be an otherwise honest person, okay? You know your roommate not to be in great need of money, okay? You know your roommate, you know, not to have, you know, gambling debts owed to, like, nefarious mafia people, okay? You see what I mean? So on the whole, I would then say it's a low probability in any kind of direct evidence that your roommate stole the $50 you're missing, okay? However, let's suppose you know, though, that the only person with access to your personal belongings is your roommate, right? And there's just no other available explanation to say, you know, why your roommate, or, you know, how the money went missing. I think you could then say that the best thing you could do there, right, the best explanation on offer would be that your roommate did it, even though there's very little direct evidence for it, and it's leaving it outside of that abduction, it's very low probability. Does that make sense? Okay. What I'm saying, though, about evolution is not just that it's the best available explanation. I think it is. I think also there's a fair good of evidence directly for it. Okay. If we get into, you know, fossil records, we get into, you know, what we're discovering about the common genetics of all living things, right? I think you can say there's much to be said for evolution, both in terms of it being the best available explanation and the intrinsic probability now that's building based on the evidence directly for it. Does that make sense? Okay. So I'm gonna put evolution out here as sort of a non-negotiable, right? It goes beyond my pay grade to argue about it, right? But I'm gonna take it as a given that our account of how you got biodiversity is evolution. Okay. All right, now, second thesis, explanatory naturalism. And what I mean by explanatory naturalism is regular occurrences in nature probably have complete natural explanations, both for each instance and their kinds. Okay? So basically, the idea, like, what I take explanatory naturalism to mean is nature doesn't operate by miracle. Okay? If you have regular occurrences in nature, things that come to be regularly in nature, then we expect that there's some sort of cause for them that occurs within nature. Okay? Both in terms of each one of them that comes about, but also for why there are such things. Okay? So, you know, hummingbirds come to be very regularly in nature, right? Okay? So we would then expect each individual hummingbird has some kind of natural explanation for it. And that there are hummingbirds, we would expect there to be some kind of natural explanation. Okay? Probably. I'm not going to say it's some sort of demonstrative, deductive certainty, but probably there's a natural explanation for that. Okay? And once again, it seems very intuitively plausible that nature doesn't run on miracles, right? And moreover, the more we've employed explanatory naturalism in the last, 500 years, the more fruitful and successful our ability to understand, manipulate, predict all these things that we look for in verification has gotten better. Okay. So once again, I'm going to take, for our purposes tonight, explanatory naturalism as a given. Now, take the human case. The coming to be of human beings is a regular occurrence in nature, right? Happens all the time, right? I've personally witnessed 6 times. It does happen. Secondly, we know that human beings as individuals come to be by perfectly natural processes, right? We increasingly understand these things, right? We increasingly can map them out. We can increasingly make predictions at smaller and smaller grain levels of what's going on in this, okay? It would then seem to stand to reason, especially with explanatory naturalism in the background, that not only do human beings as individuals come to be as through natural processes, right, but also the humankind came to be through a natural process. Does that make sense? Okay. Well, if you take that fact that, yeah, we would expect that human beings came to be by a natural process, and our best available and probably highly probable explanation for coming to be of kinds of organism is evolution, out would come, it's very likely what I call human evolution, is simply that the human species came to be by evolution. Does that make sense? All right. And so what I've done here is just to try to lay out to you what I think is just a very reasonable, common sense case for human evolution, right? To the point that I think the burden of proof is shifted here, right? I think you'd have to have very good reasons to doubt human evolution, right? Not that you have to have terribly good reasons to apply evolution to human beings. I think given the view of the world that's becoming fairly obvious to common sense, we should expect that humans were, in fact, in some sense, evolved. Okay. All right. So, is there a problem here? Well, there must be, otherwise, I wouldn't have flown in to do this, right? I think, okay, there's, as I mentioned in what I'll punt to the theologians, is there's problems with, what you do with biblical texts, right? There's problems with the fact that a lot of very important doctors of the church would have had nothing to do with this, right? Okay, those are problems, okay? But I'm leaving those aside for now. I just want to look at the conceptual issues here, okay? I think all of our worries about evolution come down to these two problems that come up that I'm going to highlight here. Okay, so first of all, there's the universal acid thesis, and that's to play on a claim by Daniel Dennett. All right. So, just following the handout, Imago Dei is seemingly inconsistent with the common descent clause of evolution. The capacities of human beings are supposedly just extensions of the capacities of their non-human progenitors. For example, reason, moral agency, religion, etc. are just extensions of behavioral dispositions we find in other social animals, and their occurrence can be explained in terms of natural selection. Okay. So that you've heard these kinds of arguments, right? Is, well, we can maybe give an evolutionary account of why human beings engage in, say, altruistic morality, right? that sees those kinds of behaviors in continuity with behaviors you find in other social animals, right? So E.O. Wilson is very, he gives this great example of there's a kind of, I think it's an ant, right? That when the colony is attacked, a certain number of these ants will run towards the threat and explode themselves in this like sticky, smelly goo that wards off the predators, right? So they're willing to sort of give up themselves for the sake of the commons, right? And the idea is that you can then see, even at that lower level of animal life, you can see a kind of, you know, proto-morality going on there, a kind of proto-self-sacrificial morality going on there, a sense of owing a justice to a group or something like that. Do you see that? Right? These sorts of explanations you see in a lot of the popular literature in evolutionary psychology now is that we can explain our tendencies towards religion, we can explain our tendencies towards aesthetics, we can explain our tendencies towards moral action, reason, all these things in terms of capacities that were there in some other more basic form in other animals. So that is once we see ourselves evolved from the same ancestors as those animals, that it's an acid that dissolves any sense that we're distinct from those animals. Does that make sense? Right. That once we admit that you have the genealogical continuity there, we don't seem so special. Alright? I think that's one problem that comes up. So if those other animals have something like that, and our explanation for having something like that comes from them, right, then it's harder to see in what sense we are special. Right, that we're a special imago dei that they aren't. Okay. Second worry. I'll call it the overdetermination thesis. The claim is, and whereas the universal acid thesis was a claim contrary to the imago dei, I think overdetermination is going to be a claim contrary to special creation. It goes like this: if the human species came about through chance mutation, natural selection, and genetic transmission, then special creation is superfluous. There just is no explanatory work to be done by posing an additional supernatural cause. There's no special act. There's no room for a special act because we have a complete and sufficient account of the coming to be of human beings. So it would seem any need to say that some deity or something acted specially to bring about the human being would seem to be at best unnecessary, right? And maybe even more so just superfluous or epiphenomenal. All right, and I think that too is a worry that you're going to see quite a bit. All right. Now, so I do think there's a problem. I think there's a tension here. Okay. I think it's soluble, but it's a problem. I want to give you common solutions to avoid, though, first. Okay, ways I'm not going to attempt to solve this. Okay. First one, it's just a theory, right? You've heard this. Evolution is just a theory, okay? And I think very often through what's going on here is there's a confusion between what a theory and a hypothesis, right? Okay, but I don't want to go into that. And the idea is a theory, you know, is something that, you know, it's maybe at best probable. It's not very certain, right? Or there might be an appeal to the sort of pessimistic induction of the history of science about how, you know, every time we get a good theory up and running, sooner or later some genius comes along and destroys it, right? And, okay, this happened. You actually thrive on that, right? Okay, you're hoping to be that guy.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's just a theory. It's as best we can tell, maybe it's good, but ultimately it's not the final story about reality because, or at least there's room for us to say there isn't because it's not absolutely positively certain. It could be wrong. Okay. As I put on the handout, evolution, like all scientific theories, is fallible. Right? It could be wrong. However, it is very well verified, both generally and in the human case. Okay, so there's a lot going for it. So it is probably true. Okay, I think I don't think it's just that it's the best one available. I think there's a lot going for it. It's probably true, as far as we can tell. To say it's probably true means that people who deny it are probably wrong. Okay, that might be too strong, but at the very least you're denying something that you have to admit there's some very good reason to admit. Okay. We shouldn't hang our hats on claims we have to admit are probably wrong, or at least have a lot going against them, even if we might not be. Okay. Evolution is our best bet as to what is going on in the biosphere. Okay. So quantum mechanics is just a theory in this sense. You see what I mean, right? The Big Bang is just a theory in this sense, okay? But those are things that are incredibly well verified, right? That there's a high probability for them, okay? You wouldn't go to a cosmologist and say, the idea that there's a Big Bang is just a theory, right? It's a very well verified theory, and so it's our best bet of how things actually happen, right? Okay. So with evolution, to say it's just a theory kind of misses the point. It's a very well verified theory, so it really is our best bet of how things went down. Okay. So I think just pointing out its status as a theory or pointing out the fallibility of science doesn't get us anywhere. Okay. Second way not to go. We don't have an evolutionary explanation for everything. This is one that, had a lot of like resurgent life in the late 1990s and early 2000s with the intelligent design movement, the famous bit, like we can look at certain, very, very complicated structures of organisms or even of like parts of organisms, and we can see that it's difficult to understand how you could have an evolutionary explanation of some of these very complicated pieces of biomechanical machinery, as we call it. Because it would seem if you remove one part from the whole, the thing doesn't really function very well, right? And so then it's hard to see how you could get that incrementally, because if you don't have the whole, it doesn't make any sense that it would be there at all, right? You've heard these kinds of arguments, okay? The problem with that kind of reasoning is it's so often been shown that, in fact, there were other purposes these biological structures served prior in the history of life, okay? So there were reasons that parts of them were kept around, right, before they formed these particular pieces of machinery, all right? And there's been some, like, very embarrassing examples to the intelligent design community of new biological explanations becoming available for things that they said couldn't be explained by evolution. Do you see my point? Okay. And I think the biosciences are right to say, yeah, there's things we haven't explained yet. There are really tough cases that we don't know the explanation for. But if you look at the trajectory of this theory, right, it keeps knocking those things down. Okay. And so once again, it becomes a sort of God of the gaps kind of argument here. We don't know the explanation for that, so that's what God must be doing, right? No, it's we don't know the explanation for that yet, right? And we can't rule out that there will be one, right? And once again, the history of the theory would tell us it's a pretty good chance they'll figure it out. Okay, at least there's a lot of cases where they have. Okay. As I put on the handout, there are relevant phenomena which evolution has not yet explained. There might even be such phenomena for which it is difficult to envision how evolution might ever explain them. That, however, can be said for any scientific theory, even the best ones. Scientific theories do not put inquiry to rest, and the gaps often get filled. And so appeals to gaps in explanation are not good ways to address otherwise very, very well verified scientific theories. All right. Third way not to go. In a way I myself used to go. Okay, so a little confession. not message. All right. Evolution is only a necessary condition for human origination, is what I call this one. And the idea here is, someone might say, yeah, well, there's a need, or the evolutionary process explains much about human beings, okay? Or it might explain maybe how you got a human body, okay? But it's not itself a sufficient explanation. It's just a necessary condition, okay? And so you're going to need evolution plus something else to explain the human being. Does that make sense? Okay. And very often the way this will go is like, yeah, you've got an evolution of a human body, and then there's this human soul that is entirely distinct from that body that you need another kind of explanation for. Does that make sense? Right. And I'll have a lot, or maybe some, to say about this later, but I want to set it aside, really, as a way to go here. Okay? Because one, if you increasingly what we're learning from the neurosciences, from psychology, right, is in order to have all the distinctively human capacities, all our candidate distinctively human capacities, necessary and sufficient for having those capacities is to have an organism with certain physical structures, right, in the right environment, under the right conditions. Do you see my point? Okay, so what we're learning is, if I knew that, you know, there's an organism right here that has the neurological structure that I have, okay, that's in the environment that I'm in, okay, that would be sufficient for me to know that that's an organism that's operating, right, as a rational animal. Do you see that? I wouldn't need to know anything else about that world, right, but that it has that physical structure and it's in that environment interacting in that way. Does that make sense? Okay, it does seem that in some sense the physical structure of the thing is sufficient for it to be engaging in these human activities. I mean, there's much more to be said about it than just the physical story. But it does seem that for it to be in those states, it's all you need is an organism that's physically like that. Okay? And if we have an evolutionary explanation of how those physical structures came online, okay, and that provides a sufficient explanation of how those physical structures came online, then it seems like you do, in fact, have not just a necessary condition for human being, you have a sufficient one, right? So the idea here is, it does seem that if you could tell me you got a world, and in that world, you have organisms built like us, interacting with an environment like we do, and evolution has occurred there, more or less the way it has occurred in this world, it seems to me I've got all I need to know that those organisms are, in fact, rational, moral, aesthetic, what have you, in the same way that we are. Does that make sense? Okay, and I think that's a bit, that's maybe the biggest challenge in the vicinity. Okay. So I don't think you can say, if I'm getting at it, in the way that I don't think you can say that my physical operation right now is merely a necessary but insufficient condition for me to be thinking, willing, you know, aesthetically appreciating all these things. I think it's a sufficient condition for it. Right? All you would need to know about the world is that I'm like this and you, physically, and you would know that I'm doing those things. Okay. Likewise, then, I think if we have an evolutionary story about how those structures got online, that was all you would need to know that indeed you had human beings like us there. And for me, that's kind of the big challenge. All right. So those are my three ways I'm not going to go to try to address this. All right, now that I've dug a deep hole. All right, I distinguish between the cause of something and its significance. All right. Consider a case of a painting, and just, this was what was on my screensaver when I was writing this. Okay, so I'm not trying to like, you know, give you some veiled message about this painting or something. Okay, all right. I know less about art than I do the Old Testament, so I'm not going to. Okay, all right. Consider the case of a painting, say Rothko's Orange and Yellow, 1956. Okay. The configuration of paint distributions, the combination of colors, the texture of the canvas, Rothko's physical movements and so arranging these elements, etc., are together sufficient to bring it about that Orange and Yellow 1956 exists. Okay. I'm willing to say that if all you knew about the world was that information, I think that's all you would need to know that Orange and Yellow 1956 exists in that world. It's sufficient to bring it about. Do you see the point there? Okay. So I think in the sense of, I'm using the word cause, that would be, you'd have a complete necessary physical condition, maybe at least not necessary, but sufficient condition for that painting. All right. Notice, however, that these sufficient conditions for the existence of Orange and Yellow 1956 do nothing to explain the significance or meaning of the painting. Though the painting is sufficiently caused by these conditions, they do nothing to explain its content or its significance. There is a content to the painting that is not exhausted by the causes that make it such that it exists. There's something innovative going on here. Okay? There's something interesting going on here. Right? There's debate about this, but there's maybe some meaning going on in this painting. You see my point? Okay? And none of that is something at all explained, predicted, etc. by those physical conditions that are sufficient to bring it about. That there's a content to it, is how I like to put it. All right. As I say again, handout, there's a content to the painting that is not exhausted by the causes that make it such that it exists. Right. In short, we can grant that something is sufficiently caused by a set of conditions while granting that such a thing has a content or significance that transcends those conditions. That you can have something that exceeds, in this sense, what brings it about. All right. I think if you grant me that, I think we can make up ground against the acid test thesis. As I put on the handout, human capacities have their origin, even sufficient causal conditions and capacities of non-human animals. But that doesn't entail that the former just is the latter. There still can be a distinctive content or significance to human behavior that is in principle different from or wholly not present in the analogous behavior in non-human animals. Though human reason may not be caused to come to be by survival pressure, that does not mean there is nothing more to modern physics than it would take to get a spear downrange towards a woolly mammoth. Likewise, though our moral proclivities may have their origins in proclivities shared by non-moral animals, does not mean there is nothing more to morality than what it took to organize in-groups in prehistoric times. Okay. So here's my point, is it could be that those very same animal dispositions, right, that we share with other animals, right, and the selection pressure on those dispositions is sufficient to bring about distinctively human reasoning, distinctively human moral action, distinctively human aesthetic appreciation, religious questioning, all these things. They can be sufficient to bring it about, but that doesn't mean there's no more content to our practices than what you see in the animal kingdom. In fact, I think nothing could be more obviously false than to say that there is. The animal is not having this kind of conversation about those practices in the way that we are, right? There's a significance, there's a meaning of those practices to us that is wholly non-present to that in those animals. Even if we can tell a story of continuity from those dispositions in the animals to our human practices. And even if we say the process by which that came about is sufficient to get us here, that in no way says there isn't a content. In the same way, you could give me this physical description of how Rothko's painting comes about, and I could say, yeah, that's all you need for that painting to come about. That doesn't tell me there isn't a content, a meaning, a significance, what have you, in the painting that is just utterly sui generis compared to those processes. Does that make sense? So I think you can grant continuity in this way with the animal, the non-human animal, with non-human animals, but still say there's something absolutely significant about us compared to them. All right. Contrary to the overdetermination thesis, and this is a little harder. Actually, let me rewind back to contrary to the universal acid thesis. If there's something in that's the content of specifically human thinking or willing or what have you, okay, that just is not something that can be accounted for by a physical cause, okay? Suppose we can make an argument. There's something in human rationality, whether it's abstraction or I like to go with logical reasoning. that just cannot be accounted for in terms of physical causes, okay? That then becomes a good reason to say, yeah, there's another kind of cause that's operating here, okay? And this whole metaphysical, you know, arena opens up at that point, okay? But I think that's perfectly consistent with still saying, right, that these physical conditions are necessary and sufficient, in a sense, to bring about a human being. At least predictive, right? That all I would need to know about a world that there are human beings who reason like us are there is that these physical conditions are met. You see my point? Even if, right, there's some very good argument, I think there is, to say there's something about specifically human reason that would say it's not something we can fit into any neat physical ontology. That, I still don't think that means we have to deny that these physical conditions are at least predictive of the coming to be. Does that make sense? I don't need to look for a gap in the physical explanation. All right, now, back to the contrary to the overdetermination thesis. I think much of this will come down to whether we take what I call a strong version of special creation or a weak version of special creation. Okay. The strong version goes like this. The way that the human species came about is evidence for special creation, meaning we think that the human species is specially created because the way we know it must have come about. We know there is a gap. Okay. The weak version just says this. The way the human species came about is consistent with special creation. Do you see the difference there? And the one you're saying, yeah, we given the way human species came about or the way it had to come about, there must be a gap here. Okay, there must be a distinct gap. Right. The other way of putting it, weak special creation, is to say the way the human species came about is just consistent with special creation. Right? We're not going to the empirical evidence and saying, yeah, we know there's something about human beings we can't explain physically, ergo there must be a special creative act here. What we're saying is, what we know about the way human beings came about is consistent with there having been, or in some sense there is, a special creative act here. Do you follow the distinction there? Okay. All right, now. For reasons discussed above, I don't think strong special creation is really on the table. I just don't think we're getting a picture of the universe where there's any kind of gap like that. Okay. So the question is whether or not weak special creation is plausible. All right. And I think it very much is. Okay. Here's an example. As I put my hand up, for example, we could say that the user interface capacities of my computer are special among its other capacities with respect to the intentions of its engineer. That's why the machine exists, after all, right? For the sake of the user interface. Okay. Without denying that these user interface capacities are in some sense caused or conditioned by other capacities of the computer. Even though a piecemeal inspection of the parts of the machine would not demonstrate this, right, the engineer acted so as to bring about that the user interface bring about the user interface in a sense that she did not bring about the other capacities of the machine. The former and not the latter are the point of the entire process. Thus, if we have independent reasons, say theological or de fide reasons, for believing that human beings are specially created by the Creator, then a naturalistic story, human evolution, is perfectly consistent with a version of special creation. Okay, so the point here is if you have something theologically that you're bringing to the discussion, okay, that we have that in our pockets already. We're not trying to derive a theology from what we know scientifically. We're trying to interpret the science in light of what we know theologically, right? It's perfectly consistent to say that human beings are created specially in the sense that we have a theological claim we're making here that we're the point of the whole process. Do you see my point there? And there's nothing in what we find about nature that denies that. And we're not trying to verify it by what we see in nature. It's something we're bringing into our interpretation of nature. Okay. I think this summarizes it very well from Cardinal Ratzinger, right?
who since has another job, but okay. The statement that man is created in a more specific, more direct way by God than other things in nature, when expressed somewhat less metaphorically, means simply this, that man is willed by God in a specific way, not merely as a being that is there, but a being who knows him, who can think about him in return, the interface, right? We call the fact that man is specifically willed and known by God his special creation. Does that make sense? And that doesn't presuppose a gap in what we know about the natural coming to be of human beings. Does that make sense? All right. That's all I have. All right. So
all right, now we're going to have about 15 minutes for question and answer time. So if you have a question for Dr. Hunt, feel free to raise your hand, and I'll let you field your own question.
Sure. But when you've had enough, shut it down.
Yeah.
Sir.
Okay, so when it comes to weak special creation, so when we taxonomically classify different species, there's a phylogeny tree that basically shows how certain traits are related in each successive generation of species leading to the species we have today, and how those all relate back to common ancestors of all said species.
Yeah.
If there was a special creation event, we would expect to see that phylogeny.
I'm not making any claim that it was an event.
Oh, okay, but like what I'm saying is if there was a special creation, we would expect to see a distinct branch of phylogeny in which we don't see characteristics of humans cropping over with other phylogenetic traits of...
I guess I don't know why you would expect not to see what we're seeing.
Well, no, what I'm saying is we don't see that, but if there was a special creation involved with humans, we would see distinct phylogenetic traits in human beings.
Yeah, I don't see why that would be the case.
Because if we were specially created, we would not have the common ancestry that we see the humans to have with other organisms.
Yeah, in the strong sense, I agree with you.
Oh,
not
okay.
In the weak sense.
Oh, okay.
I think a weak sense, and when I say weak, I don't mean like it's, going weak or something like that, right? I mean it makes less of a strong claim since it's weak in the sense that it commits me to less, right?
Okay.
And it's not committing me to anything in particular that's going to be going on what we're going to discover in terms of the descent of species, right?
Okay.
It's a claim that what it means to say human beings are specially created is that they were intended to be there or to have a special role in the whole process.
Oh, okay.
That God did not intend to be there for other animals.
Okay.
And I would say, I don't think that's the sort of thing that you could really verify one way or another empirically. I think that's something that is a de fide claim. It's claimed by faith.
Okay.
To see that. And so I think whatever would come down about the descent of species is going to be consistent with that.
Okay.
Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sorry, I was a little bit...
Yeah, no problem.
You just said that he was really long. So I guess the idea there could be that if you were to take it as that there was a creation event, that could be the first instance, say, by some mutation or whatever, of the first human with the capacities that make us human.
Yeah.
It just really checks out with evolutionary theory, but I guess maybe it could, where it's like, that first instance or that first pairing, and then all of their descendants have the qualities that we have as humans, so it's like that monophyletic group that they have the special thing.
Yeah. So I don't like to think of it that way, okay, because I think it mischaracterizes God's relationship to creation. Okay, so God doesn't relate to creation through discrete events, right? The way you and I could, like, push the objects in this table around, right? And I mean, so think of it, like, God relates to creation timelessly by one act, right? Do you see my point, right? And I don't like that way of thinking about it because it makes it look like there's this history unfolding and God's kind of sitting back waiting for the right moment, and then bing, throws a switch of human beings. Okay. How did God do it? Right, on the kind of philosophy of God that I subscribe to, one
God has one act, right? And by that one act, included in that is the creation of, timelessly, for him, the whole thing. You see that? And so theologically, I think we can say humans are specially created and that he did it for the sake of having a being he can interact with.
How is that different than from deism?
It's as far from deism as you could possibly get. Right? Yeah, no, and I don't mean to be snide, because like the idea is this, a deist thinks of God throws a switch and then he's got a universe up and running, he's sitting back watching it happen.
Okay.
The kind of Thomistic natural theology that I accept is that no, God is intimately related through his one act with every single event in the universe. You see that?
No.
Yeah, well, yeah. And partly no one does, right? Okay, but the idea is God, his contribution to the coming to be of the Big Bang, to my sitting, or my standing, sorry, right here, you sitting right there, happens for God. I mean, so God is contributing to all those things simultaneously, okay, eternally in him. Did you see that? Okay. And so I just don't like any time we talk about God as having this sort of standing outside, watching history, and then sort of jumping in, mm-hmm, throwing switches occasionally. Right.
Wouldn't the incarnation then be one kind of switch thrown? Like, okay, yeah. I guess I know if you take like with John's gospel, it's like, yeah, Jesus always was, but yeah, he also like entered history at, yeah, a specific point.
One's a miracle. Okay, so you know, so if we're going to go switch throwing with miracles, I can tolerate that, right? But even there, I would point out is the incarnation is not a change on God's side, right? It's a,
okay,
change on our side, all right?
Okay.
Okay. Not a theologian, right? Okay. All right. So it's not a change on our side. So the incarnation as an event is eternally present, you know, for God in his one single act. Right. And so anytime I'm going to talk about philosophy of God stuff, I always want to say we've got to get out of God being sort of externally related to creation, right? In the way that I'm externally related to the things that I cause in the created realm. He's related to everything inside out eternally. Yeah, Father?
Yeah. I wonder if you can, in the middle of your talk, you talked about creation, your children, like hearing evolutionary time, kind of you see that one time, that can you explain the difference of creation, creation of animals, the creation of children, kind of, can you use that case to see a difference? Does that make sense?
Is
there a difference between creation, like right now, the human beings versus the creation of animals? Correlate that to the evolutionary time as well.
I think so. One of the things that I've become impressed by, right? Impressed by the wrong words. It's just so obvious. Is that human individuals do come to be by a natural process, right? And it does seem that all I need to know that you get a human individual is that natural process has occurred. Do you see what I mean? And so whatever we would think of like a special divine contribution to the coming to be of human being, another doctrine we've got to think about, right? Okay, of the coming to be the individual human being. It can't be that the physical events aren't in some sense sufficient to bring it about, at least in this sense, that all you need to know about a world is that these physical events have occurred and you get a human being out of that, right? Do you see that? And so for me, then, that becomes a very good argument for evolution, right? So if you've got human individuals coming about by natural processes, and of course there's a part-whole fallacy lurking back here, so I'd say just probably then the whole species, if it hasn't always been around, came about by natural process, right? So I think the fact that we come, like what we understand scientifically about how a human individual comes about is exactly the same way we understand scientifically about how non-human animal individuals come about, to me makes a pretty good case for saying, yeah, we should just think of ourselves in these evolutionary categories and ask them, right, indeed, does that really undermine anything that's essential? And I don't think it does. And I don't even think you can commit this to a materialism by any means. Yeah, sir.
So I think there's a couple ways that maybe you're able to see title question here. And one, I think you definitely convinced me on, which is that Christianity is consistent with evolution. But I think another question that you might ask is, let's suppose we didn't know that evolution was true, and we discovered that fact. Should we raise our probability of Christianity being true or low?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Is it evidence for Christianity?
Yeah. So I think it almost has to be the case that you lower your probability for Christianity. Here's why.
Oh, because we changed our mind about it, right? Because we've kind of changed our mind. Yeah.
That's one thing, right? Yeah. The other thing is just that, you know, naturalism is consistent only with something like evolution, whereas Christianity is consistent with either strong special creation or this weak kind of special creation.
Yeah.
So it seems like it has to sort of divide its probability mass between those two possibilities, whereas naturalism puts it all on a naturalistic process.
Yeah.
It seems like when we open the box of history and find in it a naturalistic process, we have to update in favor of naturalism.
And by that you mean like it counts as evidence against Christianity?
Not necessarily.
I agree. I mean, so you know, if indeed it was held right that human beings came to be by a strong special creation process, right? If that was the going view, right? Then yeah, it would have to be evidence against. I don't see that as decisive.
So my argument is actually not, my argument is full, even if you're not committed to special creation, strong special creation, just that Christianity seems to be consistent with both strong special creation and this weaker version that's that involves the naturalism coming into being human beings. Whereas naturalism is only consistent with the naturalism.
Yeah.
So it looks like, you know, Christianity has to put some of its probability on strong special creation and some on weak. Where naturalism puts it all on a naturalistic process.
Sure.
So when we discover that it's naturalistic,
right,
it seems like our update, thinking in a kind of Bayesian way, has to be in this direction.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I think you're right. Right. But I don't think it's defeated.
For sure.
Right. Yeah. Someone write that down, because I want to think about it a lot more. That's really good. Okay, if you could. I want to need your email address. Yeah, sir.
So another question is the section that you talked about, call is the
yeah.
You use the example of the painting to illustrate the point that there is a meaningful distinction between cause versus significance. Because, however, it seems to me that the significance of the painting is observer dependent. So it felt to me that the painting might not have intended significance of meaning. It's only the case that when we assign meaning to art, I guess my question is that are there any examples that maybe can be used to make this distinction between cause versus significance that are not observer dependent?
I don't know that I think you're assuming that in order for me to say there's a significance to human practices that isn't present in the practice of progenitors.
For example, that painting may have very little meaning to an animal, like a low full animal. So I guess I was trying to argue that the significance of that painting is actually something that we attribute to the painting.
I have no problem if you want to say the significance of human activities is not intrinsic to the human activities, but to our attribution of it to them, because here we are still, you know, attributing significance to them. That's not present in the
scripture. Actually, kind of sounds like a Imago Dei. Only another artist can understand
what
the art is.
Yeah.
But then the issue with that approach, would it be like before humans come into existence, then we just have to assume that
Yeah, I have no problem saying a kind of aesthetic possibility came to be, just using the hanging on the art example,
right?
A kind of aesthetic possibility came to be with the coming to be of an organism that could attribute this to physical objects. I have no problem saying that. In fact, that's us. I think that's why we're different, right? It's because we have that possibility, right? That we can interpret things,
right?
And I think interpretation will always, in at least for one side, be, you know, viewer dependent.
I have a counter argument to that claim, and that is, if someone takes the time to make a painting, even if it's a bad painting, there is a reason behind it, and that might be personal enjoyment or the confusion of others.
Which may be what Rothko was doing, right?
Or boredom.
Yeah.
All of which have meaning. Because it's an action.
Sure.
So I would argue that there is a meaning at the lowest level. The level is I'm interested in manipulating an object for the sake of manipulating an object.
Yeah.
So it's an assertion of self.
Yeah, I guess I don't see. Keep going, because I want to know where we're
going.
Yes, I'm countering the argument that there's no meaning in the painting. That there could possibly be no meaning in the painting. There has to be some... There is always an exertion of self.
Yeah.
And that is the lowest form of meaning.
Can I make a distinction? Can I make a distinction?
Go ahead. I'm talking.
This is a fanciful philosophy distinction. Let's say you had some extremely improbable event brings about, you know, Rothko's painting without any intention of human action, right? And no one sees it, right? I'd be willing to say, yeah, in that case, without an interaction with a human being, the painting, well, one, in what sense is it even painting, right? That distribution of colors is without a meaning, okay? But I agree with you, anytime a human being brings something about, right? It has a significance that isn't present in non-human bringing it about.
Yeah.
It's a kind of, we care. Like, as John Hoglund puts it, it's one of my favorite, you know, recent quotes, is the difference about human beings is we give a damn, right? Like, we care about what we're doing. It has a significance to us, what we're doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you so much for coming. Let's thank our speakers.